compressed.
That's right. Good afternoon. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, 2015. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And just so everyone knows, Chair Kenny Geyer is excused, but she just texted me a moment ago and said she is watching. So everybody wave hi to Chair Kenny Geyer. And so she sends her thanks, and she's paying attention. On that note, we'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 951. And can we please have a summary of the bill?
Certainly. Chair Stark, members of the committee, Senate Bill 951 comes to us from the Senate Committee on Human Services in Early Childhood with unanimous support. The bill modifies charge size, composition, and duties of Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, makes composition discretionary, removes ex officio members, permits commission to appoint non-members to subcommittee, remove the requirement and function of budget advisory committee, requires committee make specific recommendations as a part of its long-term strategic plan. There is no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has been issued, and I believe it has a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. And Senator Mona Anderson here to share with us about it.
Thank you, Chair Stark. Members of the committee, I'm State Senator Lori Mona Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland. I'm happy to bring you Senate Bill 951. I've served on the Alcohol and Drug Commission since its inception, and recently we've really had a major problem with that commission in having meetings because it is a 28-member board, and we can never get a quorum. And so we really need to have an Alcohol and Drug Commission in this state. They can focus on prevention of alcohol and drug abuse. They can focus on treatment programs. They can focus on the agency budgets. They can make recommendations about how and we could be doing business better and smarter. So these are major changes, well, not really major changes, but they're more technical changes that will hopefully then be able to have a very efficient and productive commission. Thank you very much.
Great. And do we have any questions for the senator? All right, looks like they're letting you off the hook easy. Next, we'd like to call up together.
Yep.
Together, we'll call up Heidi Moad. Moad?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, thank you. And John Eames.
Would you like to go first?
No, I like you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Heidi Moad. I'm Governor Brown's public safety policy advisor. And shortly after I started working in the governor's office, I asked to take over the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission because I believed that obviously public safety and alcohol and drug issues had a lot in common, though I recognize that, you know, not every person with an addiction problem is also a criminal justice issue. But nonetheless, I asked to take it over, and, you know, having taken it over, I want to echo what Senator Manas Anderson just said. It's a great idea in concept. Unfortunately, the size of the commission right now is just too large. So I looked around at some of the other commissions in my policy portfolio, and the Criminal Justice Commission is an incredibly streamlined and efficient commission. I believe is well respected in this building and gets a lot of projects handed to it by the legislature. And so it's my hope that by streamlining the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission to look more like the Criminal Justice Commission as a model, not as a subject matter, that we can make a difference here, and that we can identify efficiencies, as Senator Manas Anderson mentioned in her testimony. One of the ways that we can do that is with the ability to be a little bit more flexible with who we appoint to this commission. And just as an example, right now it says county commissioners in there, and I've spoken with AOC, I've spoken with the community corrections directors, and probably would end up putting a community corrections director on there as opposed to a county commissioner, just right out of the gate, just as an idea. But it gives us that flexibility to find the stakeholders that really want to be involved in the discussion. And, you know, I thank Senator Manas Anderson and Representative Greenlick so much for co-sponsoring this bill, because this is an issue that the governor's office is really passionate about getting going, and we just have not been able to get traction in its current form. Thank you.
Why don't we hear from both of them before questions?
Great. Thank you, Chair Stark and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association, otherwise known as OPRA. They're the statewide association representing alcohol and drug treatment centers, prevention and recovery specialists here in Oregon. So, and I've talked to Ms. Moad about this ad nauseum, and she was kind enough and thoughtful enough to include us in the discussion of how this bill should be crafted. And we're not here to oppose the bill by any means. We understand that this is absolutely necessary to be able to have a functioning committee. But what I am here to say, and I've also shared this already with the governor's office and others, is that it's a bit sad that we're at this point, where we have had a commission which was originally intended to be that powerful commission, where we had the agency directors, because this is because substance abuse cross-cuts numerous agencies from education to public safety to transportation, not just healthcare. And what's happened now, so what we did when we originally crafted this, and this came from Attorney General Kroger, is that we put on the directors of each one of these agencies to attend, as well as a representative from the governor's office, as well as a number of folks in the community. And yes, it was very difficult to get a quorum, but that in itself is a sad statement, frankly, for our state. I know a number of you, and I know Ms. Moad cared deeply about these issues, and I just hope and I wished that we would have been able to have a committee that did function and that people valued enough that they would attend, you know, simply attend. You know, you hear of other commissions or health policy board or others where they don't have problems with quorum. They don't have problems getting folks there. And so we want to use this as a reminder that, once again, we've got to focus on this issue. It doesn't go away, and because we can't get meetings, we can't have enough people come to our meetings, we have to, as a state, come to terms with the fact that this is a priority, and it needs to be a priority. Funding-wise, if you were to look at the funding right now for addictions, it's not a priority. Yeah, I think that would be fair to say across the board. So we just wanted to use this as an opportunity not to say that the bill is bad, but that it's sad that we've come to this point and actually have to do this to be able to make it a functioning committee. So that's all I'd like to say, and thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to understand why they had a choice. The executive department, executive branch wasn't able to make agency directors show up? I mean, what's the point?
Chair Stark and Representative Evans, I would say that our quorum problems were not strictly because agency directors were not coming. So, agency directors were not necessarily the only reason we had a quorum problem. Again, it was an ambitious meeting schedule. It was a monthly commission schedule. So getting everyone available on the same day was difficult. I would say that our agency directors came when they could. But one thing about the way the commission language was originally written was it wasn't even a designee issue. So if Colette Peters, the director of the Department of Corrections, could not be at a meeting, she couldn't send her deputy director in her stead. And so we still had, that was a quorum problem as well. And agency directors, as you are aware, have a lot of meetings they have to be at. So even when we really tried very hard, we talked about going to quarterly meetings just to even help with the quorum problem. But that was not received well either. So this was my
follow-up.
Yes.
By whom? Who didn't receive it well?
Committee members. The commission members. Chair Stark, Representative Evans. Committee members really want to meet monthly. They want to get some good traction going. And I would say that although I don't see it as a negative that we're pulling the agency directors out, and let me just quickly explain my reasoning behind that. One, the Criminal Justice Commission, again, is the model. If we need to hear from these agency directors as the commission, we can still ask the agency directors to come and make presentations and talk to us about issues. So I think that's fine. And two, I think as collaborative as as you want to be as an agency director, and I think all of the agency directors that were working on this commission wanted to be collaborative. At the end of the day, there is some difficulty in calling one another out and in saying, I should be the one with all of this money, right? And so by not having the agency directors making the budget decisions, by having objective stakeholders and consumers of what those agencies are putting, looking at the budget, I actually think that's better for moving the ball forward.
And if I might, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmons, I do agree. It's a balance, right? Because if you can't get the folks there that need to be there, then it's useless anyway, right? Why have a committee, right? And so you have to have it be functioning. And while it's a set, I'll let you go ahead and interrupt me. Yes.
Here's my point. Either it's the best model, or it's not. If it's the best model, then we find a way to encourage agency directors to get to the meeting.
Sure.
If it's not, and this other thing will work, okay, but...
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Evans, I absolutely think we should give this other model a try because, again, something is better than nothing. And if we can't produce anything from a committee, then there's why have the committee? I think, again, as Ms. Moad had said, our goals and our ideals and what we thought is like kind of like a dream, you know, didn't come to fruition. And it was... for a variety of reasons. It wasn't necessarily just simply because people didn't care. They all cared. Absolutely, they cared deeply. But if you can't have it be functioning, then you got to go with a different model. And you have to go with something that hopefully will produce something that, and if we can, and look at it again and say we can strengthen this and add some more people because it's not getting the high enough people up on the totem pole, then let's look at that. But I don't want my message to be necessarily that we're moving in the... that we're moving in the wrong direction, because I don't think we're moving in the wrong direction. We actually have to move in the functioning direction.
Repairs?
So my computer's taking this opportune moment to try to refresh itself, so I can't pull the bill up. So can you please share with me who's being sort of stripped out of this, because I didn't think I heard that from anybody. And so let's start there. Which agency heads are no longer going to be required to participate?
Chair Stark and Representative Parrish, what we've done in the commission as it exists today is a list of 28 members to include agency directors from Department of Education, Department of Corrections, Oregon Youth Authority, Youth Development Commission, Oregon Health Authority, and Department of Human Services, and Attorney General and the Governor. And the governor was the one person who was allowed to have a designee in all of those, a senator and a representative, and then a whole host of stakeholder-type members. So what we did was strip out the ex officio members, which were all of those agency directors. And we also changed the language so that we had a little more flexibility in what stakeholders were there. So to say, you should consider having people from these segments of the stakeholder population, but if I can't get a representative from the hospitals, then I have a little more flexibility with finding other people in the healthcare world.
Okay, so my follow-up then is, so the agency people, when you say they're ex officio, so they didn't have a vote on any work that was being done?
Is that right? Yeah. Our executive director is here, so I'm going to have him come answer
some
technical
up.
Questions.
More the merrier.
Jill, introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Daniel Ward. I'm the executive director of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. The ex officio members are ex officio in the sense that they are on the commission by virtue of their job. So the director of the Oregon Health Authority, whoever that is the member. So initially it was Bruce Goldberg, and that has changed, and there's a new director, which means there's a new member on the commission. The other 60% are people who were just selected and approved by the governor's office.
Appointed
by the governor to become members.
Can I follow up? So So if you had a, like, sort of a decision-making process where you said, because I've sat on plenty of these and found a way to show up, but you raise your hand and everybody gets to vote, do those agency, when I say ex officio and I'm a board member in the business world, that person doesn't have a vote, they're sort of just there hanging out and participating. But so does Lynn Saxton have a vote on this commission?
Yes.
And now we're saying we don't have, she doesn't have to participate under this bill.
As it is right now, Representative Parrish, everyone on the commission has a vote except the appointed senator, the appointed representative.
Never get a vote.
And the appointed judge.
We show up, but we don't.
And the logic of that is they're in a different branch of government, so it wouldn't be appropriate for them to vote. But everyone else has a vote, the ex officios and all, which means that to have a vote pass, you first have to have a quorum of the voting members there, which is 13 people.
Last sort of more comment than anything, I think, is I don't mind if you take the AG off of there or some of these other spots. I have a little bit of heartburn, though, with somebody from DHS and somebody from OHA not being required to participate in something that's important when it is a huge piece of the work that they are doing, either in the delivery of social services or in the delivery of health care as it relates to addiction treatments and mental health. And I wouldn't want them just to be show up at the call of because we're asking you invited testimony kind of thing. I actually think in something like this that eats up hundreds of millions of dollars of our budgets across social services and delivery of health care, that they should show up. This is a really big key piece of why we give them money, and to not participate at least those two positions, I wouldn't support this bill as it's written just because of that reason, because then they come and say, we need more money for addiction treatment. But, you know, this type of thing is that level of participation about how do we do this, and now we're having other people outside of their wheelhouse make those decisions doesn't feel good to me. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that this committee would consider at least all those other agency heads, that's fine, but the two that are delivering these services and we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars should be required to have a seat at the table. And whether they want that seat or not, they should be there and participate is my two bits. So.
Give you a chance to respond.
In fact, all those different departments are providing some form of drug treatment or drug prevention services. You're exactly right, though, that Oregon Health Authority and DHS are the biggest spenders of the bunch. If we compare it to the model of the Criminal Justice Commission, it seems to me reasonable to expect that if the group can become effective, those people will be there because they will have a lot at stake. And whether they have a vote or not, they will do whatever they can to be involved in the debate. And they will certainly be welcomed.
Rep. Peluso?
Thank you, Chair Stark. So how many people are on the Criminal Justice Commission? What's that number?
Representative Peluso, Chair Stark, that is, a flexible membership, so it operates, I think there are probably 12 to 15 members at any given time. Okay. They have a little more flexibility, which is what I tried to cook into this
right.
new version.
Follow up, please.
Can we, Jonathan, answer?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go, continue.
So I think most likely everybody in this room has sat on commissions and work groups and all those sorts of things. I will respectfully disagree. I really don't want my department directors there. When I was the chief of police, I sent my designee or the person who attended those sorts of things. The closer they are to where they're doing the work that's on the ground, the more they have the knowledge and understanding of the needs. And we all would have staff or the people that we would select to go in our places where, as a department director or an agency head or a police chief, I really believe our role was to be more of the supportive than the actually. I could tell you stories from when I, did something as a street cop, but it was 20 years ago. So what's the value? So I think there are really a wide variety of ways to staff as well as to fill those commissions. And I think you all have the challenge of finding that right mix of people. It is not unusual for a commission to fall apart or a work group to fall apart because it's not the right mix. So I don't see this as a, I think this is a real positive corrective step. It's not saying anybody did anything wrong. It just perhaps the right makeup wasn't there. And I do think 28 people is way too many to try to manage. So, I just see that, and I, again, our highest paid employees, I don't know, need to be at a monthly meeting.
So, Rep. Hayden?
Interim Chair. Start. Thank you. I see this kind of as a teachable or a learnable moment for us, coming from a business background, in transitioning into a public employee here. Pretty much in business, success is not by the CEO of the company, but it's by the people that surround him or her in that position. And so what I see this bill doing is actually improving on the status quo, not a step back. I see it as a step forward, because I think it will encourage the department chiefs, or whatever their title is, executive director, depending on what department you're talking about, then they will have encouragement to assign to them somebody that works with this and has the passion for it, and their job is to show up, but their job is not to take care of the whole state on all of the issues that that department handles. And so I see it as a step forward.
Well, can I follow up?
Go ahead.
So I will say, maybe not Lynn Saxton needs to be there, but somebody from that department should be there. Sure. And have a vote. And this bill doesn't actually do that even. It takes those people out of, takes OHA and DHS completely out as I read it. They aren't now participating. Their designee or anybody from those two organizations are not in this bill.
Chair Stark and Representative Parrish, that's correct. They would not have a vote. And that was from where I sat, a little bit by design, because I don't know that, again, as I said, when we start talking about budgets, I want objective analysis of budgets as opposed to, I'm not casting aspersions on any director, any agency director, but it is your job as an agency director to protect what you have in your world. And I want people from the outside looking in to say, this is working, this isn't. You know, yes, we've done business this way all along, but there are these better models that we, the CODAs of this world, the treatment providers of this world, are administering at the local level. So that's why, again, I think it would be incredibly critical to have the agencies participate and present. I'm hearing from you, you don't think that's enough. I respectfully disagree. I think it will be, and I think this is a way to get them engaged in a different way, but still a meaningful way.
Rep. Evans?
A comment more than a question.
We've got a lot of those today.
I do. Mm-hmm. For a reason. I spent 3 years as a policy advisor working on things that built work groups, built task forces, built commission things. And my concern weds a couple of things that have been said. I absolutely agree with Representative Peluso that as a chief you would send a designee. My concern is if the agency director doesn't know they're on the hook to send somebody who actually has the authority to speak, you will end up circling and circling and circling and never ending getting a decision. As somebody who respects the bureaucracy but fears it at the same time, making decisions are the hardest things that occur, and whether it's the actual agency director or the certified smart person who works for the agency director, whoever it needs to be, I don't frankly care. What I do care is that it seems to be that this is a priority, a policy area of priority. And I am skeptical when agency directors are given more autonomy and less accountability anytime, not with regard just to this bill. So I understand what you're trying to do, trying to get attendance up and trying to get more of a focus. I guess I'm just very disappointed that agency directors didn't come forward and say, could we send designees instead and try to fix it that way instead of trying to change the entire membership.
Chair Stark and Representative Evans, I will say that that was discussed. The possibility of going to a designee only was discussed. I personally didn't want to do that for a couple of reasons, the ones I've already said, and I don't need to keep restating my opinion that it was not to the benefit of the agencies to be fighting over their own budgets, but also it's the size. I mean, a 28-person commission is just such an unwieldy commission to actually get anything done. And so when I looked at who I thought could bring the most to the table, I think those agencies have will benefit from being informed by stakeholders. And that's why I chose to go with a stakeholder type commission.
There. Further questions?
One more.
Lisa?
Well, just late breaking news from our chair, who has sent me a message. Please tell the committee I question if it should meet monthly as it does now. I think six times a year is plenty.
Chair Kitty Geyer, where you are, and Representative Peluso, I agree. I think a monthly meeting, and I frankly was one of the members of the commission pushing for quarterly meetings. I think every other month is a great goal as well once we get to a smaller group size. And Executive Director Ward and I will work on that moving forward.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Apparently, I need to pay more attention to my cell phone when I'm chairing. I personally put it away.
And I'll take care of this for you.
Excellent. Well, if there's no more questions for these guys, I would encourage if you have great concerns and you want to propose amendments, then please get with Mrs. Moad sooner than later so this doesn't dwindle out there for a long time.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who would like to be heard on this bill? All right. Well, on that note, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 951, and we will open an informational meeting on aging in Oregon. And I'd like to call Jerry Cohen, Phil Bentley, Alan De La Torre to come up and share with us. And we're shooting for 45 minutes or less on this.
10 so. Minutes or less. Chair Stark, esteemed committee members, and up in ether sphere, Chair Kenny Geyer, we wish you a very speedy recovery. For the record, my name is Jerry Cohen. I'm State Director for AARP here in Oregon, formerly known as the American Association of Retired Persons, but we're not retiring souls anymore. You're right, we have a short amount of time to give you everything you'd like to know about aging, but we're afraid to ask. We've promised not to bring a fire hose for you to drink from, indeed are suggesting a 30,000-foot view, so put on your seat belts, make sure your tray tables are back up, and get ready. I get to give you the numbers, but I'm going to try to provide some data numbers in ways that hopefully provide some ahas, maybe debunk some myths and concerns when it comes to aging, something hopefully all of us are doing given the alternative. So on that note, I don't know if I have to do any pressing on slides. If you don't mind. Oh, perfect. There's my help here. So a couple of quick points in terms of the power of numbers. I'd like to show some slides that get into some demographic shifts that we are going through, where we've been.
Jerry.
Yes.
Before you get going, now that I interrupt you.
Please.
Would you rather people raise their hand and interrupt and ask questions while you're going, or wait till you're done?
I go to the pleasure of the chair. I think it may be helpful to ask questions as I go through.
If they're minimal questions, then we'll ask them.
Sure.
But if we start going off on a tangent too far, then we'll let them finish up.
So. Right. And again, remember, it's a 30,000-foot view, and we'll try not to hit too much air turbulence on this. So, on equity and diversity issues, in particular, wanted to hit a couple of issues that often aren't talked about, LGBTQ and veterans. And while there's been a bit of information on Alzheimer's, I wanted to reinforce that and some of the implications. Again, a little bit of data around retirement, income, labor market, but I'd also like to talk about economic impact on communities, and essentially how are older Americans, or Americans as we age, are responding. So next, for those of us that may have gone through some type of demography classes, and I have to admit I often slept through some, you know, traditionally we thought of that great pyramid back in the turn of the 20th century. Not that many people live to be much older. And if you look at 2040, and if you can hit the next slide, we'll get right to Oregon. We're looking from just 2000 to 2030 forecast. By 2030, we're looking at a little more of a rectangle. So I wanted to highlight that because it does show a real shift from that old pyramid perspective when it comes to age and aging and across the various age segments and lifespan. So next. Again, I apologize if I'm going too quickly here, but again, feel free to ask questions. And what I wanted to accentuate on this particular piece was the fact that for many of us, aging in our 50s, 60s, I, by the way, turned 63 on Friday. Thank you very much. But as we age, it doesn't necessarily mean a certain age, like I turned 60, I turned 65, oh my gosh, everything goes downhill. Thank goodness, it doesn't happen that way for most of us, not all. But the reality is that as we hit certain areas around 75 plus, particularly age 85 plus, the reality is for many more of us, there are more and more challenges, chronic conditions that really jump in. And what this slide shows specific to Oregon is, not to be complacent, but in terms of baby boomers like me that you have to worry about, for most of my age counterparts, the real challenge is going to be in the next 10 to 20 years as more and more of us start to lose that age benefit dividend and start to experience more perhaps challenging disabilities. But I'll turn to our next speaker to cover some of those challenges. So real quick as to takeaways when it comes to looking at that shift from the pyramid to where we're at now and where we're going. The first is, for some of us, again, it was this idea of the silver tsunami and this pig or rabbit being eaten by the python. You know, if we just get through these darn boomers like me, then, you know, things will settle down. But the reality is that we are going through, in the United States and in many other countries, a real demographic shift. And the fact is that we're looking, and this is a blessing, of multiple generations. So I can turn to my right and left and around and look at younger folks that are going to be almost equal in terms of distribution. That's an opportunity, not just a challenge. It is a permanent shift. The bulk of our population in terms of aging and as far as boomers needing significant care and resources really hasn't hit yet. It's continuing to grow, but we still have a little bit of time to invest. And as I pointed out before on that last slide, the biggest impact comes within the next 10 or 20 years as the first wave of the baby boomers are really living far longer and starting to experience more significant challenges in terms of health, physical and cognitive. So let me move on to a little bit about equity and diversity. And as I said, I apologize in not going through some of the specifics around ethnic cultural diversity, but I did want to hit a few areas that often aren't highlighted. And one is around LGBTQ adults. And I wanted to accentuate the positive here. The one negative or major frame of negative is both fear, real and imagined. I highly recommend, by the way, a film called Jen Silent. It's a PBS documentary some years ago. AARP and others have been using it for orientation and training for long-term care staff and adults that identify with LGBTQ communities. But this particular film, Jen Silent, and it will be in the materials.
Oh, it's in here?
I'll be forwarding
that. Oh, that kind of
Jen.
Got it.
That particular film accentuates the concerns that individuals face when it's suddenly like, do I have to go back in the closet, so to speak? Am I being treated fairly and equitably or not? Again, without going into all that data, what I did want to accentuate was that in spite of the challenges, there are some positives in terms of wellness, physical activity, spirituality, and one thing that caught my attention, it leads to the slide that we're going to hit in a second, is the significant number of both transgender and bisexual men who served in the military. Something, you know, again, back to demographics, and it's continuing to grow in terms of self-identification. So that leads to the next, and I have to thank our newly hired Director of Aging Services within the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, Mary Yeager, formerly the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. But Mary was able to quickly, knowing we had little time, some data that over the past 70 years, never before has her agency that she works for in Oregon experienced, and this is nationwide, four generations that fought in five different conflicts. And that's not even talking about those in peacetime. So that's a huge number. One out of 10 Oregonians is a veteran. And we're talking veterans in terms of the National Guard as well. Sometimes we don't talk about that, and it's growing. One of the things that hit me, and I put it on here from all the data that I have from Mary, is that only 3 out of 10 currently are accessing federal benefits. And yet, as you look, those federal benefits relate to what's spent in community. And as you see, over the increases in the past just decade are significant. 2 times on whether it's the overall federal VA spending, health care, 2.5 times. Education in particular, significantly growing for any number of reasons. But again, as we see an aging population of veterans as well. So, moving forward, it's not just demographics, although I'm trying to accentuate here that numbers and the whole profile is indeed changing. You know, when it comes to retirement, and I as I mentioned, AARP is just ARP now. We changed our name actually about 12 years ago when we recognized that at that time over half of our members, and there's 38 million members, 500,000 here in Oregon, that aren't, half of them aren't retired and seriously not retiring. So we had to recognize and go with the logo. But that's true of a lot of organizations finding that retirement isn't what it used to be. So let's hit a couple of quick points. One is back to savings and pensions. And I always look at the 1980 and say, my dad is in there. My dad retired after 52 years working for Gimbel's department stores in Milwaukee with two E's in Wisconsin. And dad was able to get a defined benefit from Gimbel's. Wasn't much, but it, you know, back in the 1980s, $180 a month guaranteed for the rest of his life was meaningful to he and my mother. So That was what it was true then, and you can see by 2010, and sad to say it's changed even more. If you can get a 401k with your employer, and in Oregon half of employees do not, the point is that I have to invest. I'm responsible. I have to put some money into my 401k, not just my employer, depending on how much they're willing to put in. So as you can see, a real shift in how one saves beyond Social Security. And as an aside, Social Security was never meant to be the sole funding source for us in retirement. That was never the intent from the enactment back in 1935. Changes in savings, thank you, he's already anticipating, is, and I have to tell you that savings has gone down dramatically over many decades now. And the recession accentuated it, where a number of individuals, and I can speak anecdotally of a number of my fellow then 50-year-olds, now 60-year-olds, had to draw down on their IRAs or their 401ks. So we're looking at actually depletion of savings as well since the recession. And back to work. We had seen until, well, really, about 2000, a dramatic earlier and earlier retirement take advantage of age 62. Boy, I'm out of here. I can do this. But because of the economic situation in terms of rising health care costs, because I'm not eligible for Medicare until I'm 65, until we started looking at the recession, you can see that's all been flipped around. We have a significant change now in terms of, and this happens to show men, I would say women just as well, more and more working longer, more often than not because they have to. So the next slide just shows one of the trends, and we're seeing is that retirement is changing in the workplace, and more employers are finding, or small businesses finding, there's a change in looking at what type of job am I doing? Did I lose my job during the recession, and now I'm doing something very different, but trying to use some of my skills. In essence, I have to work, and it's because I have to make a choice here of continuing to work, for a quality of life, or do I actually go for a lower standard of living in terms of choice, particularly leisure care?
Chair.
Yes, sir.
On the reentry rates, are there numbers that distinguish reentry based off of boredom and desire and financial need?
Chair Stark, thank you. I don't have that data in front of me, but I know that AARP, among other organizations, has actually done some research looking at that, particularly from the perspective of encore careers. Mark Friedman, who created Civic Ventures based on a book he wrote some years ago called Prime Time, when before the recession he assumed particularly middle and upper middle class folks would retire earlier and then go back to work, but in a more altruistic sense, has done some seminal work on that. But we'll be glad to provide any and all information on that as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that gets to it's the economy, as one presidential candidate some years ago framed. It's the longevity economy. And I just wanted to emphasize something that, again, came to my attention in the past year. AARP, working with the Oxford Foundation and others, actually began to look at what do older workers and older consumers give back to community. And without reciting too many numbers, the fact that we're looking at a huge increase of $77 billion in Oregon's gross domestic product. In terms of percentage of employee compensation and state taxes, there is a benefit, at least for those years of productivity as we age, that suddenly that magic age of 62 or 65 isn't necessarily a, oh, now you are unemployed and not contributing to the economy, that we need just to focus on young creatives. So beyond that, next slide was transfer payments. You know, we often think and worry about those, the label we've used of entitlements. I'm not sure I agree with the word entitlement. Programs like Social Security or Medicare, which we've all earned to say by paying into. But the fact is that this particular chart shows Oregon, in terms of federal dollars, over $5 billion that comes in a year for Oregon on Medicare that is spent in those communities that do have the type of programs and services, hospitals, healthcare providers, long-term care, that do actually meet needs and therefore expand and provide jobs and a boost to the economy. At the same time, I could wish, and again, I could have hit you with a lot more data around Social Security, Veterans Affairs, those other transfers that are of benefit in local communities in terms of exchange of dollars that otherwise, if the federal government stops its largesse, we would not have. And in fact, would put greater burden on our social safety net that the state runs. The last slide gets back to, I think, a question of back to small business and encore careering. And that is, in part measure of the recession, and part of it from those that are in a position to say, I'm bored, I'd like to try something next, we've seen a significant increase, not just in Oregon, but around the country, in those that are self-employed. The data I have here is from the Small Business Administration work taking place in Oregon. And what, again, caught at least my attention, and that's why I'm pointing it out to you all, is that we see a significant number, 17% of those ages 50 to 64 now, that are actually self-employed, that were not self-employed before. In other words, are encore careering, whether by necessity because of the recession or because of altruism and or a desire, let me try something different. So as I said, the numbers, and my role was to quickly highlight some numbers, the numbers here are to plant some seeds of thinking a little bit outside of the usual stereotype of that silver tsunami that, oh my gosh, the sky is falling, and what are we going to do with all us old people, i.e. me? The fact is, the hope is that all of us, like my late mother and father, will live to be ripe old ages, relatively healthy until the near end, with dignity, choice, and independence, and the opportunities that we as communities and the state can provide. So I hope that this quick overview provided you a little bit of information and understanding of some of the opportunities as well as challenges we have. And on that note, questions or handoff to our next esteemed presenter.
Unless there's anything burning, shall we continue?
Sure.
All right, let's keep going.
Thank you. Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Phil Bentley with the Oregon Healthcare Association. OHCA represents more than 700 long-term care providers throughout the state, and my task today is to give you a general overview of the long-term care system here in Oregon. And just as a side note, a lot of my presentation will focus on seniors, but I do want to point out that we also do serve a number of individuals under 65 but who have physical disabilities. So when we talk about long-term care, what we're really talking about is a continuum of services that bridges the healthcare, social services, and housing to provide the supports that people need who are living with chronic health conditions or disabilities that affect their ability to perform daily living, activities of daily living. And those long-term care services and supports include assistance with getting dressed, taking medication, preparing meals, using the restroom, getting in and out of a bed, and just about any other daily activity you can imagine, managing your money, your finances, getting to the store, those types of things. And national data shows that someone turning 65 today has about a 70% chance of needing some type of long-term care during their lifetime. The legislature in ORS 410 has actually established a state policy on aging, and it says that Oregon seniors are entitled to enjoy their latter years in health, honor, and dignity, as well as independence. A reflection of that policy in the long-term care system is to provide the appropriate level of care, and in Oregon we have an emphasis on home and community-based care. So what I'd like to do now, just briefly, is kind of walk you through the continuum of care, and I think some of this may be familiar to you and some of it may be new, depending on your background. What a lot of people think about in terms of long-term care is nursing facilities, and nursing facilities are actually the smallest part of the long-term care continuum. Those are licensed facilities by DHS. They provide 24-hour care, and they're really designed to address the most complex or highest acuity levels of people needing care. One of the increasing areas where skilled nursing facilities are being utilized is post-hospital stay to rehabilitate from a surgery, a hip replacement, or something along those lines. The next area is a residential care facility. These are also licensed facilities that provide 24-hour care, and they also provide specialized care for like memory care units for people suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's. Residential care facilities are kind of a subset of, assisted living facilities are somewhat of a subset of residential care facilities. They're also licensed, but the care setting is more of an apartment rather than a congregate living situation. And then you have non-licensed settings such as independent living, senior housing. These are basically communities that cater to folks over the age of 55. They don't coordinate care, provide those types of services, but they may have other amenities that people find attractive. We also have a system of adult foster care homes in Oregon. These are in-home settings with five or fewer individuals who are not related to the foster home provider. And finally, we have in-home care agencies, and these agencies actually coordinate care for folks in their homes. And you can see from this next slide, just in terms of the numbers that we're talking about, the vast majority of folks are actually receiving care in either community-based care, which includes assisted living, residential care, adult foster homes, or in their homes, is the vast majority of where long-term care services are being received. This is another slide that kind of depicts that. So only 13% of Oregonians are receiving long-term care in a nursing facility, and the rest is in either home or community-based care. Just to share with you a little bit about who is paying for long-term care, you can see from this slide that the largest payer is Medicaid. which is funded by the combination of the state and the federal government, and within the nursing facility arena, also a provider tax. The next largest payer is Medicare. Medicare has a limited long-term care benefit for seniors. Going down pretty close after Medicare's out-of-pocket expenses, and then private insurance is less than 10%. And then there's a little bit from the Veterans Administration. We do have two veterans homes here in Oregon, in the Dalles and Lebanon, and that comprises a small amount of long-term care spending. Who do we serve? In nursing facilities, as I said earlier, a lot of it now is post-acute care at shorter stays or folks with high service needs. A lot of folks are coming directly from the hospital, doing a short stay, and then moving on to their home in most cases. In the community-based care setting, I think it's no surprise to learn that 66% are female. Women do have longer life expectancies than men and do therefore end up needing long-term care services. 54% are over the age of 85. One of the trends that we're seeing in long-term care is that people are entering at a later date in their life and staying for shorter periods of time. Most folks have at least two or three chronic health conditions, and some of the conditions that we see are dementia, hypertension, heart disease, and diabetes. And 40% need assistance with three or more activities of daily living. A little bit about our workforce and who works in long-term care. It is a predominantly female workforce from the ages of 18 to 44, and most have a high school diploma. Giving you just a snapshot of average wages in the different care settings, you can see it ranges from around $11 up to $27 for a registered nurse. I will say that working in the long-term care setting is hard work. There is turnover and there are challenges to work in this field. Some people might say you need to have a calling to do this type of work, and being a caregiver is something that is rewarding, and you can move up the economic ladder and scale with increasing your skill set and your certifications, but it's also very challenging work. And I would also just point out that everyone who works in a long-term care setting does need to go through a background check, criminal background check by state law. Some of the challenges that we're facing in our workforce is just the general kind of medical professional shortage, particularly nurses. There's labor market competition with acute care providers. Frequently, we'll have nurses work in our facilities that get their training, get their experience, and then they may go work in the local hospital or with a physicians group or somewhere in the acute care arena. We actually do have challenges getting everyone trained. One story I heard from one of our members down in Southern Oregon is that Rogue Community College has a challenge keeping a master's level nurse on their faculty to teach the classes, and then they also limit the number of spots in their college because it's a more expensive program to deliver. So we have folks that are trying to hire and they're having a very limited supply of new folks coming out of that program. So I talked a little bit about turnover and just the general broad labor market, rising costs. Those are all, you know, factors that we deal with in the workforce. A little bit about some metrics and how we measure success in the long-term care system. One of the things I think we're very proud of is AARP has rated Oregon as having the third best long-term care system in the country. I think a lot of that has to do with the investments that the legislature and the partnership that we've had with the legislature over the last few decades, as well as our emphasis on community-based and home care. We have a low rate of hospital admissions. As I said, we have our lengths of stays are decreasing. It's about 125 days for Medicaid and about 29-30 days for Medicare. And we have a low nursing facility utilization rate, which I've discussed. So one thing I just wanted to take this opportunity to share with you is a little bit about the partnership that the legislature has had with our long-term care system, some of the issues that are before you this session. We were very pleased to get some funding for a caregiver training initiative that came out of the special session. We've had about 4,000 people participate in either online or in-person trainings. And one of the really significant things about these trainings is they're not just for professionals, they're also for family caregivers. And a lot of caregiving in this state is provided by family members and not in a professional setting. And the other thing before you this session will be just basic inflationary COLAs for care providers who serve Medicaid. And not all care providers can afford to serve Medicaid. And that's something that I think, you know, we need to make sure is available to low-income seniors in all parts of the state. And then finally, I just want to point out that AARP has spearheaded the CARE Act this session. It passed the House unanimously. It helps patients and their family caregivers transition from hospital to home. And with that, turn it over to questions. Thank you for having me today.
Questions? Well, I'm curious, you mentioned the workforce shortage. What is being done to address that?
Chair Stark, the workforce shortage issues are something that I think we are always thinking about ways to address. And we would like to see more engagement with some of the community colleges and other folks who do the trainings. A lot of what we're seeing is that people are getting their trainings in more private settings rather than community colleges. And so it's a conversation that we're having on an ongoing basis and would welcome new ideas. It's a real challenge for us.
Okay. When Alan's ready.
Yeah.
And there he is. Ready? I'll try to man your slides.
Oh, there you go. Thank you very much. Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Delatorre. I'm a research associate at the Institute on Aging at Portland State University and the president of the Oregon Gerontological Association. I'm going to change the focus a little bit to age-friendly communities, and you may not be familiar with that term, so I'm going to give a little bit of background before talking about what's happening in the metro region, and then talk about some Oregon data that have been collected recently in partnership with AARP, DHM Research, and OPB. So to get started, if you could advance to the next slide. The age-friendly movement is a growing focus of communities internationally. Grantmakers in Aging, which is a consortium of grantmakers at the national level, has recently put out a publication on age-friendly communities, which talks about the fact, there's a wonderful quote, and if Phil, you could advance to the next, that many thought leaders now believe that the communities that fare best in the 21st century will be those that both tackle the challenges and embrace the positive possibilities that an aging population creates. And so the real focus here is moving away from this needs or deficit approach and looking at aging as an asset and a positive aspect to our communities. If you could advance. Talking or framing what an age-friendly city is, it's important to note that the terminology city was used in the early work that was going on with the World Health Organization, and it's been broadened to cities and communities now because we understand the importance of looking beyond just urban areas. But an age-friendly city is one that is both inclusive and accessible. It promotes active aging, which I'll touch on in just a moment. It emphasizes enablement rather than disablement, and it's actually good for all ages, not just for the 65 plus or the 55 plus. So we think about planning for communities for older adults, but for mothers with strollers and everyone in between. The WHO framework for active aging is really focusing on optimizing opportunities for health, participation, and security across the life course. And if you're familiar at all with social determinants of health, there are some similar frameworks that are used to understand individual determinants of health as well as population or characteristics that exist at multiple levels. So just a little bit about the global network. So there are 258 members throughout the world in the WHO's global network of age-friendly cities and communities, 12 affiliated programs throughout the world, which includes AARP coordinating the U.S. Version. There are 54 network members here in the States, and three of those are here in Oregon, two of those being in the metro region, which I'm going to talk about for just a moment. And then there are other programs across the country and the world that are also focusing on this that aren't
are not part of the WHO AARP initiative, but are still striving for similar types of goals. So with respect to, if you could advance one more, the timeline, and I'm not going to touch on every single issue here, but think about 2006, a basic research project being launched by the World Health Organization. They contacted Portland State University because of some international work that we were doing. They said, are you interested in being involved in this? We signed up as the only city in the United States to be involved in that 33-city, 22-country project. We're actually, according to the Life Course Director for the for WHO, the only city still from that original 33 that are continuing this work forward, although many of those cities in Canada have now been subsumed by a Canadian effort. So, but we have longevity when it comes to this international project. The work that's going on at the Institute on Aging is internationally recognized as being ahead of the curve in a lot of this work. After our basic research project in 2010, there was a clamoring for some additional way to get involved in age-friendly communities work. So the WHO launched their global network. In 2012, AARP launched their national network. And the city of Portland joined shortly thereafter to continue their work, not just doing research, but implementing what those findings were and really building an action plan to further the city. So just recently, within the last year, Multnomah County also signed on. So we now have an age-friendly Portland and Multnomah County project. I co-coordinate that project with the director of the Institute on Aging, Margaret Neal. And the work is really starting to take off. We've got two work sessions with county departments throughout the departments. It's not just about aging, disability, and veteran services, but we're working with whether it's the health services department, we're working with the library, and all of the departments across, which is really important for this initiative. Just to cover quickly the domains that we do cover, I could quickly break them down to three general areas, being the physical environment, the social environment, and the service environment. And you can see that the WHO eight domains that are on the left have been expanded because we thought that there were a couple of really important things to focus on. So we took civic participation and employment, broke that apart into civic participation and volunteerism, as Jerry talked about a moment ago, and really focused on employment and the economy because we see this as a critically important issue. And then the community support and health services, we broke apart to two different areas because there's so many community support services and healthcare is such a critical aspect of what we're doing. Currently, there are five subcommittees that are carrying on work in housing, transportation, civic participation, economic development, and health. So I want to quickly turn to some data that have been collected over the last 5 to 6 months that we're looking at. So these are preliminary findings. We shared May 1st for the first time some of these findings, and we'll look to have our final report to share with folks within the next month and a half to 2 months. So this was about Oregon values and beliefs. And for those of you who may be familiar with DHM's research, they've done work across the state in values and beliefs. We wanted to focus on generational issues, values and beliefs that were really affecting the 45-plus population. So when we asked to rank the most important age-friendly areas, the first priority that emerged was health services in Oregon, and I'm going to focus on Oregon here. The second priority was housing, third, employment and the economy, and the fourth was respect and social inclusion. But I do want to note that transportation ranked fifth for those who were 65 and older, so transportation became more important for those who were older. When we asked how important it was for communities to become age-friendly, 47% of Oregonians felt that it was fairly or very important to move toward this effort, even more at the United States level, which is really interesting. And then moving on to the next slide, when we asked to rank the top three objectives regarding meeting the future needs of seniors and people with disabilities, the top response in Oregon was to stay in their own homes and communities. The second was to achieve and maintain financial independence, which is also a very important issue that's being dealt with here at the state level. And then the third was to serve all people in a manner that they choose, so person-centered or patient-centered care. When ranking the top objectives regarding future needs of seniors and people with disabilities, the top one was aligning housing, transportation, and social needs, social services. The second was providing better information, access to information. The third being more support for caregivers, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. And then the fourth being providing more physical and mental health promotion. I'm also working on a project right now regarding older adult behavioral health specialists that are being hired across the state, which is such an important project. The fifth was to create more livable communities, and the final one was to provide more access to a range of transportation options.
Ellen?
Yes.
On those two studies, those numbers are, or those rankings, were there other things on the list, or six things were put and they had to rank those? Or how many things were actually put on the list?
I believe that there were 10 things that were ranked on that list.
Okay, and that's the same total for the list before? There were 10 things and those were the top three?
The list before was actually an open-ended question.
Okay.
So people, and so there, some of these, Chair Stark, excuse me, I'm kind of new to this testimony thing.
Oh my.
They were asked in an open-ended way to rank those, and so some of these answers have been consolidated to really address those three main points.
Thank you.
So just really quickly to touch on caregiving, it's important to note that aging and caregiving are kind of similar issues in that they really affect all of us in some way. As Rosalind Carter had mentioned at one point, sometime either in the past, in the present, or in the future, some of us will either be caregivers or will be cared for. And so this is something that we really need to look at as a personal issue for us. With respect to caregiving, the average age of a caregiver is 50 years old, and the average age of a care recipient is 77. And just to touch on some of the financial implications here, in the United States, there's $450 billion of unpaid caregiver services that were given. Here in Oregon, $5.5 billion by 500,000 people in our state in 2009. So it's a major issue, and this is unpaid labor. There's some small payment that goes out in Oregon to some of the caregivers, but generally speaking, this is unpaid labor.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
Again.
Yes.
So are these friends, family, spouses, all of the above?
Chair Stark, yeah, absolutely. Mostly relatives. So I think 74% of all of the caregivers are related to the person that they're caring for. And other than that, acquaintances and other folks who they know or are meeting. Jerry might know a little bit more about those data.
No, Chair Stark and committee members, indeed, as Alan related, vast majority of family members related. But then the rest are either congregants, friends, that jump in. And I guess the key here is, but for these unpaid caregivers, we'd be looking at very many more that would ultimately qualify for Medicaid for Oregon's long-term care system in terms of taxpayer-supported care. So point is that the vast majority of Oregonians, and indeed nationwide, that receive care from family or friends without the cost directly to the taxpayer.
For these last two slides, I want to focus on housing for just a moment. So this is regional data that was created or pulled together from the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, or the Oregon Economic Analysis Office. So we know that in the metro area from 2010 to 2025, that there's going to be over 300,000 new households that will be added. Over half of those households will be headed by somebody age 65. Mm-hmm. Over half of those households, of the new households. And so this is a real issue with housing and services. We need to be aware of this and understand. I actually included in the packets, and I'll send the PDF version of this after I return home today, a small short article that I wrote for Aging Today about the need for innovative approaches to housing our older adults in the future. There's a growing disaffection with institutional care, but there's still a need for it. And so understanding who has a good fit in long-term care and who's looking for community-based options and how to support those individuals living in the community is really important moving forward. So the last, I want to show data related to housing types. So we asked for folks to rank their top three options when they considered if they were to move from their home in their community. The top option was a single-family home, and I think that that's common knowledge that people across the age spectrum actually enjoy living in single-family homes. But surprisingly, there were a number of other options that were mentioned. So home share options were the second most popular response. The third most popular response was small one-story homes clustered on properties with other small homes, cottage housing, cluster housing. This is not allowed in a lot of Oregon communities because of zoning code issues. Apartments and condos were the fourth ranked option, co-housing developments, which are growing in various areas of the state, including senior co-housing. And then the last option were accessory dwelling units that were on a property shared with a house. And there are ADUs or accessory dwelling units allowed in certain municipalities in the state. So with that, I've finished. If you have any questions, it's a great time.
Rabil,
what is co-housing?
Chair Stark, Representative Bueller, co-housing could very broadly be described as a condo-style development where people buy into not only the condo that they own but also a common house so that they've got access to a shared kitchen and a meeting space. They share things like lawnmowers, potentially cars, and decisions are made by consensus. So it can be a messy process at times, but it's something not quite communes, which is an issue of the past, but co-housing in that it's a collective approach to housing folks together.
Other questions, Rep. Parrish?
So, you know, we're looking at this bonding money potentially for housing. Certainly, senior housing, as someone who's on that tax force, is a, you know, I think is a critical piece. I mean, I brought a bill this session. We didn't hear it or work it, but that would have given a property tax appreciation where we roll you up every every year 3% freeze for low-income seniors as a way to sort of help them keep in their home without having to. Any income that they're bringing in might not be appreciating as fast as the taxes on their home. And I think of a woman in my community, for example, who has a situation where I would say you're probably land wealthy and cash poor. Mm-hmm. And the minute you turn that asset into liquid and then go live in a facility, I mean, you're just going to draw that asset down. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping she's 86 this month. I'm hoping she hangs out for another decade or so because she's pretty active in our community. But she's starting to be priced out of her home mm-hmm. because of that, you know, constant, and she pays a fair amount of taxes.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, personally, and as we look at that $100 million and what that could look like, one of the things that you sort of threw up there, and I would call it more of a, maybe not the sort of shared dishwasher type situation, mm-hmm. but more of a co-generational housing model of saying, if you know, she's got a decent sized piece of property, mm-hmm. she could put a small accessory dwelling unit, rent it out, you know, as affordable housing, have somebody who's there sort of checking in on her. And I did not see that in the housing director's plan for how we use that $100,000 is that type of innovative where you don't need a whole lot of, you got to go buy a piece of property and things like you could actually site one there with right. that bonding dollars and then, you know, do like a rent share because, you know, help her out, but help somebody else out. I mean, I think we have to start getting a little more creative because this notion that we're going to build big complexes or edifices to anybody in poverty or generationally mm-hmm. or even veteran type housing is just is not going to work. And we certainly start to segregate people in those housing models and they're not being integrated well into the community. Do you have thoughts or ideas about other types of housing as we talk about that $100 million? I mean, I'm not comfortable spending it on 10 plexes and 50 plexes where we dump poor people or dump seniors or whatever.
Absolutely.
Into like you're going to all live here together. That doesn't feel good to me.
Chair Stark, Representative Parrish, that's a great question. I think that this is an important issue as we move forward because there's some issues. So older adults who are overhoused have the value of their home. Hopefully, they're not paying that down because of a move to a more expensive facility. I think in some ways, looking at home share or the Golden Girl style housing situation is one potential option. Another thought, so there's a model that's being developed right now to think about 10 to 12 person units that if we think about FTE, building FTE for a caregiver who might live near or in a house as well to support environments, this wouldn't be taking a single family house and having 10 to 12 people living in this, but thinking about new housing prototypes that would allow for people to live together, even in the cottage housing style, it wouldn't have to be shared walls. They could be single family, single stories on the same piece of property. My father, my sister has a disability and will live with my family for the rest of her life, they're thinking about building an accessory dwelling unit in their property to try and allow that flexibility to say, my sister can live there, they can live in the front. But in the next 5 years, when my sister's not living with him, my dad will live in the accessory unit and rent the primary unit out to a family who needs housing or to students who are going to school at Walla Walla School of Nursing, which makes a lot of sense at this time. And I think flexibility is really the key, a big key of what we're talking about here. There's also the village model, which is something to point out. So this is a grassroots community-oriented initiative that's in all over the country, actually, the village movement is happening. And this is more of a package of services to allow for people to stay in their home over time. So you pay a certain amount of money up front for yearly services, but you've got folks who can come over, change a light bulb, help with yard work, and do those supportive types of things that are much less expensive than a lot of the long-term care options that are out there. And not to say that long-term care options are not viable for some people, just not for everyone.
So, one of the things in having that housing conversation, and we've heard it a lot this session, is, we need 50,000 units of affordable housing. And, so my general pushback on that is, well, we don't have 50,000 homeless people. The problem is that the housing's not affordable. We have units. We could certainly use some additional units, but we actually have units. And particularly for this population, my fear is sort of this notion, like, are we going to go out and build a bunch of these units? And the reality is there are two of you serve for every one of me. And at some point, that number is going to change, and you build all these facilities, and there's this push to build these facilities, and 25 years from now, you're not going to necessarily have the number of people, right? The Gen X generation is not necessarily going to fill all those beds if there's this push across the country right now to build a lot of senior facilities. When the boomer generation is no longer with us, there's just not enough people to backfill those facilities. So I personally like the models of sort of the temporary accessory dwelling type things and smaller community housing that can be repurposed. And so I'm sort of curious if you at PSU have really weighed in on what should we be considering if we're going to use a portion of that bonding dollars for housing, senior housing, what does that really look like, and best recommendations, because I'm not seeing that in the $100 million plan.
Ellen, before you answer on that, if you don't mind, can chime in. Jerry, I thought and what Rep. Parrish just said and what you said were two different things. He was trying to say in his presentation that the idea that we have, this mass of people moving through like a, rat in a bubble, that the actual population numbers, yes, this mass has come forward, but the numbers have stabilized so that it'll continue to have that same number.
And what I'm saying is across the country, there is a push to build senior-type facilities, villas or assisted care living or whatever. It's not just in Oregon we're building these things, but they're sort of building them all over the place. Yeah. And at some point, there's a diminished return because the population eventually won't match the need, right? So, and those are very big, unwieldy structures that can't easily be repurposed. A senior assisted facility, if you have sort of a declining, 30 years from now, have a declining need, you're stuck with a big building, right? So, how are we out of the box thinking about what those types of beds look like in the future?
Chair Stark and Representative Parrish and committee, I guess my personal thoughts are that even today, the question is, over time, is a large institutional-type setting, and I'm saying institutional in the broad sense of large number of people congregating of a particular age, really what individuals want and will populate? Because I think in some of the studies that Portland State has done in the past and OARP has done in terms of looking at what defines a viable community among all of us across age segments is a community that's actually fairly integrated. For the most part, and there are curmudgeons out there, but for the most part, there are individuals as the age that want to be around young people. Now, they want a security and safety and all those nice things and access to health care, but the reality is, in terms of thinking of whatever the housing is, it meets a number of the items that Alan hit in terms of the domains that allow for engagement in community and still being valued, no matter how frail I am. So I guess my long-winded answer is, I would agree, but I also would point out demographically, there's always going to be a need for a segment of our population that's going to need significant care and so skilled facilities.
Absolutely. I'm not saying there isn't.
Back to your point.
The push to overbuild potentially is out there right now as these needs are growing and we're seeing those needs. And what I'm saying is rather than sort of say we need X units in Oregon to meet this, can we think of other ways to do that? Because eventually maybe we don't need X units down the road because the population is going to change. The demographic of it. Yeah. My kids will have a bigger generation and maybe need those, but it's, that's a long way out.
And Chair Stark and Representative Parrish, you're absolutely right. I have a millennial as a daughter who's getting married this year, and she does happen to actually have an ancillary dwelling on her property and has pointed out to my wife and I, much to our chagrin, that it's there for us when we need it. The cats live in it now. But seriously, the concern is, again, over time. We may not have as many Xers as as millennials or boomers, but the fact is that there'll always be a need for something. But I think your major point I'm hearing, and indeed we're looking at, what are the creative options that are there in terms of various housing community options? And again, I would point to the demographics and say there's a lot of opportunities that would also engender economic development in terms of community businesses as well.
Can I just add one more thing, since like half the committee's gone? More than half is like the three faithful. One thing I've seen some studies on, or some, and I don't remember where I saw this, was a couple years ago, and it made a lot of sense at the time. And of course, we do everything in silos, right? So we're going to do old people over here, and we're going to do veterans over here, and we're going to do seniors over here, and we're going to do education over here. But a model where you're looking at, like, if you're going to build, say, a K-12 school facility, for example, that piece of land is being thoughtfully built and wrapped around, that there is sort of some senior housing and that sort of co-generational connection on that same piece of property. And when we build sort of these really big $26 million LEED certified buildings in our district, but there's like acres that are sitting there sort of unused, and they make great wild space, but that doesn't connect people who are seniors who actually have skills and things they could bring into that classroom and being connected. And I know that there have been some places like that built, and I don't know exactly where. I remember reading it that people were doing it and saying, intentionally designing that we're going to put pair children and seniors together so we can bring those seniors back into the classroom and help sort of the volunteerism and the education opportunities that go with that, but intentionally making that readily built together as planning. And of course, we're not talking like that in this building, but other places and other states are. I'm just curious if you looked at that at all.
Chair Stark and Representative Parrish, a couple things. So Bridge Meadows is a great example in North Portland of an intergenerational community. So it takes foster families and older adults and puts them together. There's requirements that the older adults are actually providing services to those families to create an intergenerational environment where they're learning from one another and with one another. And to get back to the question that you'd asked before about the bond and some innovative thoughts, and it actually applies to the question as well about designing well, this idea of universal design being out there. So if we're designing apartments that are going to be lived in for an age-segregated community of 55 plus that are designed well, they're going to work for families in the future as well. It's just good design matters. And so, for example, hallways that are 36 inches and doorways that are 32 inches will allow for a wheelchair, a walker, or a stroller to get through. Lever handles on doors that you can use your elbow when you've got your groceries rather than a knob that you need to actually drop your groceries and pick up. Also, kind of ideas about the garden apartments that exist throughout our state. How can they be repurposed in some way to create social connectivity and social cohesion in those communities? And why do we build so much housing with steps leading up to the front and leading out the back? The answer to the question is that we live in a rainy climate, and so we do a lot of that to protect ourselves from rain coming in, but thresholds can also be used to eliminate that. And every 2, 3, 4 steps that we add, there's a barrier that we have, not only for us to live in that home, but for our families and our neighbors. And so the concept of visitability, which is actually in Oregon statute, is something that not only should be looked at in more depth, because I don't think that the current ORS statute around visitability is really used very effectively, but how can we promote people to start thinking about the reality of aging, because we live in a death-denying culture, which is not that easy, actually.
Yeah. And Chair Stark and Representative Parrish, and I know you've committee would like to move forward here, but I did want to add, Alan is actually attending a conference, presenting at a conference in Southern Oregon Saturday, and Rogue Valley. So I'd like to point out there are some centers of excellence really trying to get into the whole issue of universal home design, planning ahead for neighborhoods and communities, and not just in Portland. Springfield, Oregon is another area where we're beginning to just sign on as a World Health Organization, AARP, age-friendly network, with that in mind. So I just emphasize there's lots of opportunities to learn and grow, and so we'd be delighted to provide more information without fire hosing you.
All right. Well, so given that this is a informational meeting, not on any specific bill, we have plenty of time to dialogue on that, online or offline. So thank you for your testimony today. On that note, we will close the informational meeting on aging in Oregon. Anything else for the good of the order?
No.
Chair Kenny Geyer, if you're still watching, you're still in our thoughts and prayers, and we're praying for a quick and recovery for you. On that note, by the way, there was no meeting on Friday for this, and we will adjourn.
Yay.